Hey guys, just a little disclaimer. This episode is super inspiring and it's probably one of my favorites, but it can be very graphic and it might be a little disturbing to some. So just a little heads up as you listen. Okay, enjoy the podcast.
Congratulations, your visa has been approved. Welcome to Beyond the Passport. Fasten your seatbelts as we journey together around the world.
Yeah, a few years ago, Vijay and I went to Kenya. That was 2018, 2019, something like that. Mm-hmm. I was in Kenya with Taj and Wati, a group of friends of mine. We were in an area called the Masai Mara National Reserve. We went there.
First time in Africa.
Yeah, it was one of the most, I think one of the most amazing experiences, you know, first time in Africa growing up. You know, growing up, I really fell in love with National Geographic. You know, I hate reading. But I'm always in the library just checking out National Geographic's pictures about Africa. And, you know, you have these shows that you watch, Discovery Channel, Bear Grylls, the survival shows. And Africa is one of the most, you know, growing up, just impressive. You know, yeah. I was like, man, I want to go there growing up. And so when I was there, a really, really amazing experience. And so today we have someone from Africa. From Kenya, to be exact. Some people are angry when you talk about Africa as if it's like a country. So, but we're specifically talking about Kenya. And our friend is Miss Kim. How do you pronounce your last name again, Kim?
DeWitt.
Okay. Can you tell us more a little bit? Okay, just a little background before you get in, Kim. Kim, we have a project. This year, 2022, which month did we go there?
Around February, January.
February. Yeah. We went to Kim's place. We were working for a project for a organization called Child Impact International, which Vijay worked as an editor and also worked as a filmmaker. And we are supporting Kim's trust. And she's going to talk more about that. The Al-Malaika Trust. And we're going to talk more about that as we move forward. But Kim, can you give us a little background of who you are? Where are you from? What do you do?
Sure. I was born in the U.S. And shortly afterwards, my parents decided to come to Kenya as missionaries. So I actually left the States when I was just 2 years old and was raised here in Kenya for about 12 years. Then Beirut, Lebanon for a few years, evacuated to the island of Cyprus, and went to high school in Singapore. Then back to the U.S. and now back to Kenya.
Wow. Went to, what was that? Let's a little recap. From the U.S. To Kenya.
2 year old.
From 2 years old. And then where?
And then to Beirut, Lebanon.
And then to Cyprus.
For a few years. That was during the worst part of their civil war, probably.
Oh, wow.
So we spent a lot of time in a bomb shelter. And then finally, we were evacuated to the island of Cyprus.
Mm. And then you went to Kenya.
I went to high school in Singapore.
That was a lot. Okay, so that's like three continents.
How was school like, Kim? Were you homeschooled?
At all? Ever? No.
No, for grade school. Because you were in Kenya and then Lebanon.
No. Yeah, in all of those places, I went to either mission schools or to American schools.
So you're a boarding school child.
Yes. Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about, Vijay and I went to the Masai Mara. We spent some time there. I think we spent like a month or so. Mm-hmm. I've done three trips to Kenya and it's all in Masai Mara. I've done some in Samburu land and all that, some places, Kisii and all these places. But Masai Mara is very special to me. Number one, the safari. Amazing safari, of course. The Masai Mara National Park. Mm-hmm. But I think one thing special for us is that we've lived with locals whenever we're there. You know, and so we would go to safari houses and all that like fancy glamping situation. But my favorite part is just living with the Masai. You know, and talk to us about a little bit about the Masai people. Like, who are these people? What are they about?
The Maasai live along the whole southern part of Kenya, and they trickle in the northern part of Tanzania, same, our Maasai. And they're nomadic, so they, cattle, sheep, goats, they're herdsmen. They move the herds according to the rains. If it's dry, they'll walk hundreds of miles to get grazing areas for their cattle. They they're one of the few tribes in Kenya that stayed very traditional, stayed to their culture. When Kenya was colonized, they pretty much refused to change to the Western ways. Wow. And I think that's a large drawing card for tourism, because it's so much about them sort of takes you back in history to maybe what you read as a child and imagined versus others who wear Western clothes and don't walk around with spears and exactly. things like that. Yeah, I think there's a big attraction with tourists. When people come to Kenya, you never hear them say, oh, I can't wait to see a Kisi person or a Kikuyu. But everybody's like, ooh, I want to see a Maasai.
That's true. I remember we went to a Maasai village.
The Boma.
And in Oboma, one of the biggest Boma. I forgot the place of the Mara we went in. But I remember they went to they gave this traditional dance, the guys. And we were told that the tradition says that the higher you jump, the bigger possibility, the more chances of you getting a wife. And the highest jumper gets a wife, right? From the elder and the chief. And Kim, I tell you, man, I was jumping. I was, you know, if I knew how to do backflip.
Didn't measure up at all, right?
I did it 3 times and I'm still single.
You didn't get off the ground.
You don't need to do me dirty like that, you know? But anyways, I was jumping so hard. I was like, but unfortunately, I'm still single. It's
unfortunately, you proved that tradition wrong.
Yes, exactly. It's a scam. That's what it is.
Yeah.
But anyways, back to the Maasai. I remember VJ and I, remember when we drank tea?
Oh yeah.
It was like, okay, we drank it for like a couple days. Yeah. We didn't know it was made of blood and can you tell us more about that?
That's a scam too.
Yeah.
Actually, historically the Maasai warriors would mix blood with milk. I think it's more of a protein. Oh. Sort of iron in with cow's milk, but for the most part now it's not done. And it might be done at a special ceremony or something like that, but often when you go to their villages and you talk with them as tourists nowadays, most of what they say is kind of recounting the past and how it was.
So no more blood.
No.
Okay, that makes me feel better. I drank so much of that stuff.
Yeah, it was like, oh, yeah.
Nowadays, tea is just tea leaves and milk and sugar and some water.
Good to know.
So we're good.
Good. Yeah, but it's amazing. I've heard like the older ones, you know, they have this big like holes in their earring, in their ears as their earrings. Really interesting. And some of them are legit fought lions. It's wild. And
it used to be to prove your manhood, you either participated in or you actually had to kill a lion. But because wildlife is protected nowadays, it's no longer necessary, or they've foregone that part of their
and I've heard cult. I've heard, Kim, that now because the Maasai, they are only the only tribes inside the park, and they're not supposed to be people living there, but since it's their home, you know, they live with people, and now they have clashes with their cows, the cattle, and the wildlife.
They in the Maasai Mara, they don't actually live inside of it. They live on the edges.
Okay.
And when we have dry seasons and a lack of rain, they'll often take their cattle into the reserve, because the reserve doesn't have fences around it. The animals wander freely. It's not like a park that's fenced in. Mm. So the animals can come and go all the time. And so often they'll take their cows in to graze. And so there's some issues with that.
Yeah.
But And yeah, it's true. That does happen. And sometimes they'll, because there's tourists there, they'll take the cows in actually at night because the tourists are not out and about at night. So it's like a switch. When it gets dark, the cows move in. When the sun comes up, the cows move out and the tourists come out to look at the animals.
It's funny how Kim says tourists are not supposed to be out at night. Because we went out there.
We went outside. There was one time we were, this photo of VJ in with the night sky, and we were not supposed to be outside, but we like bribed the Maasai and like, hey, can we go outside on the Land Cruiser? And it was like, VJ, and I could hear the hyenas laughing on the background, and I'm like, oh my god, this is so scary. But I had we at least one shot, an amazing shot of the Land Cruiser and VJ standing up.
So nice.
So it was one of my favorite moments up there. But anyways, that was illegally done. Hopefully we won't be banned. But we were not eating by the lions, so that's great. But I've heard that the lions are the least of our concerns. It's the elephants and the buffaloes that kills more people.
And the hippos.
Hippo is the number one killer. And they're vegetarian. But a hippo is very routine. It doesn't have that great of eyesight. They graze at night because they're grass eaters. Mm. And so what often happens with them is somebody gets between them and the river, and they know the river is safety, so they're hustling back, and you just happen to be in the way.
There you have it.
They don't eat you.
There you have it. Be careful of vegetarians. Okay, Kim, tell us a little bit about... Okay, so usually when you go to Kenya or Africa... Mm-hmm. It's either you see poverty in the pictures and you're like, oh, poor place, you know, and all that kind of stuff. But there's a difference between people who, when you read the news, it's people are just statistics, you know. But when you live with people, they stop becoming statistics. They're just the people. They see them. You see them. And so bring us in, just talk to us about not being a tourist and just you as a person living there, because we're like, technically, even though I've been there many times, I'm still a tourist. Mm-hmm. You know, I've not lived as much as you in Kenya. Tell us a little bit of the struggles there in Omalaika. Where is it situated? And tell us about that just a little bit.
Well, let me go back on the tourist thing. I think that a foreigner is always a foreigner. And so to most Kenyans, they would look at even me as a tourist. Oh. Although there's, you know, you're always an outsider. Mm-hmm. An outsider is an outsider regardless. I'll never be a true Kenyan. But with tourism, with the longer you live here, it's just an understanding, it's friendships that make the difference. With a tourist, you're just coming to take pictures and to see and leave. With somebody who lives here like me, there's bonds that a tourist wouldn't have. But I'm located right on the edge of the Mara, probably 5 minutes from the main gate into the reserve. Our place overlooks the Mara because we're on the side of a hill in a little town, or we call it a center, called Sekenani. And that's where we have
Can I say a little bit before you forget, Pardon? Kim? If you follow Kim on Facebook, she has wildlife videos every single time. I look forward to this because she puts cameras on the fences and she always sees the elephants, the buffaloes. It's really interesting. So if you have Facebook, follow Kim or Instagram, the Omalaika Trust. Really, really interesting.
Yeah, I think because I was raised here and I camped, you know, our family would go out camping on weekends, and it's not like in the US when you camp, you have like these camp spots where you roll in and you hook up your toilet and you hook up showers and everything. Here, when you camp, you literally set your tent up in the middle of nowhere. There's no showers, there's no toilets, there's no people, there's nothing but you and wild animals. And so when I grew up, that's how it was. We would literally camp all the time, and you would have elephants in camp, you would have lions in camp, anything would be there. So so I think I just have a real love for nature and wildlife. So we try we love the wildlife that are around us here. It's really cool when you have elephants walking by. And
talk about the organization that you're with, the Omalaika Trust. Can you tell me more about that, and what does it mean, Omalaika?
Malaika in Swahili, Malaika means angel. And the Maasai, every tribe has their own dialect. The Maasai use a lot of words with O-L before it, O-L-E or just O-L. And so to make it, because we live in Maasai land, a little more Maasai, we put the O-L in front of it. So the home is Omalaika. Don't confuse it with Oklahoma.
Almost.
And so Malaika means angel. Mm-hmm. And basically it's a, we have several projects going on here, but the main thing that we're involved with is little girls that have experienced trauma in their lives. And one of those things is female genital mutilation and childhood marriage. So we take in little girls that have experienced trauma all the way down to infants, and we help them start the healing process, get education, and then eventually are able to reunite with their families again.
Wow. We did a film about this, uh-huh. but it was for a much more, you know, I don't know how to say it, just a little tamed audience. So today, just a little disclaimer, we're going to do it a little bit
more graphic,
and just the reality of it, we're not gonna mince it. So if you're squeamish and,
and maybe you're eating,
just want a heads up. But yeah, Kim, talk to us about the female genital mutilation. What does that mean? What's that all about?
First of all, I want to really thank you guys for this, because a lot of people want to ask me questions about FGM, female genital mutilation, but they don't really want to know what it is. And it's hard for me because I'm so passionate about ending it. I like to say exactly what it is, because otherwise we can talk about something that's just like using a different language, and how much did you glean if you don't understand that language. So I want to thank both of you for giving an opportunity to really share what FGM is.
Send it, Kim.
It literally goes with the name. Female genital mutilation is so key to it. And there's about three or four different types of, it's also called circumcision. So sometimes I might use one word or the other. Here in Maasai land, they call it circumcision. There's about three or four different types of it. So it can range from anywhere from cutting the clitoris off to cutting off the clitoris and the labia majora and minora, and then sometimes even stitching girls up afterwards. So it varies in how extensive it is.
Wait, I did not. Sorry, what? I didn't know that. You didn't tell us that when we were there. Stitching.
Some different cultures or tribes will cut everything off, and then they literally will sew a girl shut so that the opening for her to urinate out of is maybe the size of a pencil. And there's been cases where ladies were thought to have a tumor, and when they opened them up, they realized it was years of they're not being able to have their menstruation properly because the hole was too small. Uh-huh. And so when they had their periods, nothing left because of that. Uh-huh. So then what happens in those areas where they do the sewing up, the night that you're married, your husband has sexual relations with you and breaks that open during the act of sex. And then often the family will come in to verify the blood and everything like that. And it's a celebration to show that you really were a virgin before you were with him. So those are more areas like Somalia, some of those places. That's like a more extensive. I've known girls and read about girls that were actually sewn shut with acacia thorns. And I don't know if you've ever in your time here stepped on an acacia thorn.
Yeah.
It's like, even when you get it out, it's still a little painful.
Yeah, it is.
Can you imagine in that area, vaginal area, actually having those acacia thorns used to sew you shut?
Okay, well, if you're listening to this and if you're shocked, we're as shocked as you, because Kim did not tell us about this when we were there in Kenya. But
yeah, so then here in Maasai land, they don't usually do it to that extent, but they will take the clitoris most of the time, pull the clitoris out, and then they cut it off. Usually that's what it is, without going further than that. But our girls and people I've talked with use the expression sawed it off. There's a big difference between cutting or slicing and sawing. If you think of sawing, it's a movement back and forth. It's not just a quick slice. And in a while, you know, years back, and probably in some places still, they used to simply take a piece of tin can, sharpen that tin can, and use that to cut the clitoris off. Mm. Now, the majority of people now use a double-edged razor blade. But you can imagine a sharpened tin can trying to cut any part of you is not a quick slice. I mean, when you think of it like that. And that same razor or that same tin can is used on multiple girls without any sterilization, without cleaning it in between girls, without antibiotics, without any pain medicine, nothing. They can just go from one girl to another girl to another girl using those same instruments to do it. So it's truly, truly in all sense of the word, mutilation.
Yeah, and we want to make it clear that there's no clinical benefit or whatever benefit whatsoever for this practice, right?
It's purely cultural, and it's like a rite of passage.
Yeah, so here in Maasai land, it's considered a rite of passage from being a girl to a woman. So after you've had it done, now you're ready to be a wife, you're ready to be married off. Some people will tell you that it's also will make you less promiscuous. And it will also, some believe that it makes you more fertile, so you'll have more babies, all of which is not true at all. In fact, it causes major problems when you get pregnant and go into labor. The mother can die. The vaginal area doesn't stretch like it should anymore because there's so much scar tissue. The mother can die during labor. The child can die during labor. There's girls who actually bleed to death during the when they're being circumcised and when they're going through the female genital mutilation. They actually could die from bleeding to death from that. All sorts of infections they can get. There's absolutely no benefit to it at all.
And did you mention there's no anesthetic?
Nothing.
Yeah, no anesthetic. Just full pain.
Full pain. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you can imagine afterwards how it is as well. For days, you're sore. When you know a burning sensation down there. There's nothing they put on. Some of the girls that we have told us that they had sugar put on them. Because they said sugar helps with coagulation of the blood. Some told us that they actually took sour milk and mixed it with flies, and then they would put it on them and recoat that every now and again. I have never quite figured out the fly benefit, but it's pretty wild.
Yeah, well, this one turned from the amazing safari trip to the dark side.
Sorry.
Yeah, this is really dark. But
it's illegal, Kim, right?
It's illegal, yes. Right?
It's illegal. It's illegal in Kenya. And in most countries, it's illegal now. They're really fighting hard to bring awareness about it and to end FGM altogether. It happens in probably 30, 31 countries around the world. So it's not just Africa. but it is illegal. It has nothing to do with any religion. Some people like to pin it on different religions. Nothing to do with that. It's all cultural. And
it happens in the Philippines too, Kim.
Really?
Yeah, it happens in the South. So same thing. Wow. We don't. No one really talks about it, but now, yeah, I was doing a podcast about it. I was mentioning that there's a group down south in the Philippines, and someone commented that it's not as rampant because now it's voluntary for a woman to do it. But it's like, come on, man. No one's really want to go through that, you know?
You know, we've had girls. We have girls right now at the home who actually requested it.
Oh,
they were young, and they don't know what it is, though.
Yeah.
So nobody, other girls were having it done, and nobody will say
what it is.
So you want, you know, this peer pressure. You want to be like everybody else. And so both of them were circumcised, but they both had no idea what they were getting themselves into. And both of them have said, if we knew what was going to happen to us, we would never have done that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, some fight it and don't want it. They run away beforehand. Others request it and then wish they never had. And then some are just simply forced into
it. You were mentioning some girls were running away. I've met some of those girls who ran away and you took care of them.
Yeah. So the girls we take in here are connected with FGM. Either they've already been circumcised, they've endured it, or they were at high risk and about to be. So that's why they're here. And yeah, we have two girls, the girls that I was actually just talking about that had requested it and it had happened to them. They were young and they actually are now with us because they were circumcised. The husbands-to-be came to the home. They saw them. They said, this is our only chance to get an education. We know another girl who went to this center, this little town, and she was safe. So it got dark. They slept together in their little miñata. And then about midnight, they ran. Mm. And they ran literally through the Masai Mara Reserve all night long without any light, without anything. And by morning time, they reached where we were. They went to the school.
Wait, they went through the safari camp with all the wild animals and survived?
Yes. I said to them, you know, they actually told us how they had to sit and wait sometimes because they could see elephants ahead of them in the darkness, and they had to just wait behind bushes until then. I said to them, you could have been killed by so many things. And they said, we would have rather been killed then been married off.
Oh my God. How old are these girls, Kim?
They came to us probably maybe 13 years old. But we have girls here who were married at 8. So they were actually circumcised maybe at 7 years old and then had husbands. A couple of them had husbands that might have been 60 or 70 years old and they were only 8 years old.
Okay. I've also heard some stuff where some of these girls are even tied to the tree and their knees and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, this is really, like, when I was there, it took me a few weeks to properly sleep at night. hearing these stories, because that really just affected me. And, you know, okay, you're probably listening to this podcast and like, wow, it's not happening to me or it's not happening to people near me and all that. But when you actually go there, when I went there, and just seeing these kids' faces, and you know their story, their face does not really leave your mind. Yeah, you just keep thinking about them.
I want to mention that these are one of the most like beautiful kids we've ever
Amazingly
seen.
Amazingly beautiful, just bubbly.
But, you know, it's important for people to realize we've had people who wanted to come here and visit, and they had like kids, maybe girls or children, sons, I don't know, 12 years old, 13 years old. And they asked, you know, what do you do? And I explained, you know, the girls here have endured trauma of different sorts. And they said, we're not comfortable bringing our children there to because of what those girls have endured. Mm-hmm. And I was like, they look just like your own children. You know, when you're circumcised, it's nothing. You don't, they don't wear a sign saying I endured FGM. You know, they're laughing, they're playing, they're normal children. So from the outside, you would never know anything had ever happened to them. They're amazing in their resilience and in how they come back and how they can, they're survivors and successful at surviving. But there's nothing you're gonna see looking at them to know what they've been through.
Yeah, I would let my daughter mingle with them.
Yeah, they're the most amazingly fun girls, even though we don't speak the same language, just hang out together, you know.
It's nice to sing with them too. Yeah. Very good singers.
Very good singers. But Kim, I remember you talking about some of these kids were put in hyena holes. You know, talk about that. Oh. Some of the kids that you adopted there.
Yeah, now we take in infants in our county, which is quite large. There's no place for babies who have experienced trauma, infants, anybody to go. So we're now officially the home in this county that takes in babies and infants. And so what happens is, unfortunately, there are occasions where babies are literally thrown away. During COVID, we had thousands of young girls who became pregnant, school kids. And so some of this we're thinking is from young girls who gave birth themselves. And in Maasai land, I'm going back a little bit, so remind me to come to where you wanted me to be. When you get pregnant in Maasai land, a lot of people give birth in their homes. They don't go to hospitals, and their homes are made of mud and manure, dark, there's no light, there's no running water. And so they have a tendency to not eat very well during pregnancy in order to keep the baby as small as possible to create an easier delivery. So a lot of times you might see somebody and not realize they're pregnant because of
baby's
them not eating well.
Oh.
So a schoolgirl can hide her pregnancy for a long time. They wear sweaters, they wear jackets, and you wouldn't necessarily know they were pregnant at all. And then they give birth somewhere out in the bush, and they might just leave the baby there and then try to go back to regular life. And so I think at least one of our girls, I feel in my heart, might have been a child giving birth to a child, a baby. But yes, we do have abandoned babies. One of them was found in a hole. We're thinking it might have been a hyena hole. She had been in there maybe for a day or so. Ants had bitten her. She had cuts on her from stones that were around her. And somebody heard her crying. And they called for help, and they got her out. And so she was in hospital for a couple of days, and then she was brought to us. But of the six babies we have right now, all of them were basically thrown away, found in the rubbish or found in different places. And then we get them as little infants, just a few days old.
So they're all DeWitt? Their last names?
No. In Kenya, foreigners cannot adopt babies.
Okay, makes sense.
So when babies come to the trust, there's a court case, and they call it a committal here, but it would be like a legal fostering type thing where they're legally in our care and until a certain date, and then that keeps getting renewed as needed. Yeah. So if you're an abandoned baby and you come to us after 6 months, if we get all your paperwork in order and everything, you can actually be put up for adoption by a Kenyan family.
By Kenyans, yeah. And just to add to this, Kim's, the organization she worked with, the Omalika Trust, they take care of them from infancy until they finish university. Is that correct, Kim?
Yeah, we have a couple guidelines that with that. So anybody who comes to the home, we look for sponsors, for donors, and then we pay for their education. Once they are transitioned home again, then there's certain guidelines that they have to follow with communicating with us, getting paperwork to us, and they can't get pregnant. And then basically we can, as long as we have a donor and they're following the guidelines we set up, we will pay as long as we can pay through university, as long as we have those things in place.
So Kim, we've been talking about girls who've undergone circumcision, abandonment, and those kinds of stuff. We've mingled with them and they look like perfectly happy kids. Mm. But like, how are they handling the trauma? What does the healing process look like for them?
And what do you do in order for them to help to help them overcome that?
I think well, we have a lot of staff here. We have a social worker for counseling. We have a nurse aide. We have extended care, a pediatrician. We have an OBGYN. We have psychologists in case there are those needs. But what we have found is simply being in an environment where you feel safe, you feel loved, and there's a sisterhood with all the other girls that are here, that alone is so huge in a healing process. When you can realize you're not all alone, that there's other people who understand, there's other people who have endured what you have, and yet you're still loved, you're still accepted, you're still valuable, that I think can boost you so far and is life-changing for many of them. And then the fact that they can get an education, that's life-changing to them. But they are a little different than Westerners, I think. I always get myself into trouble with this. It does. I know that when somebody's raped or has endured some type of trauma, we're all humans, regardless of our skin color, regardless of where we're from. We all have emotions. We all hurt. There's pain. But there are some cultures that seem to bounce back easier than others, and I'm not sure where that comes from. You know, these girls, if they were in the U.S., would be doing counseling the rest of their lives, and possibly be put on medication and all that. But here, it's like, you know, this happened to me. I have to keep going. Wow. I have to find a way to make it in life. And so I'm loved. I'm taken care of now. It'll be okay, and I'm gonna move on. And in all my years, I still haven't figured out how that works for some on one continent and how it doesn't work for others on another continent. Hmm. But there is that, there something within them that pushes them to be survivors.
How does that? What's the thought process like when you come in your, and I guess I'll say that, you know, Kim's place is really a safe place. It's like a citadel.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, go there. It's a paradise. Yeah,
it's surrounded. But, we'll put this in the description. You can follow them at the Omalika Trust. We put the link there in the description below. But there's pictures there, drone shots that I took. Man, they're surrounded by this wall with fence and electric fence and cameras, and the girls are safe. You know, it's such an amazing environment. But Kim, walk through us, what does that feel when you go and see a baby, you know, like see these kids and you know, the first time you see them, how does that even feel? You know, I can only just listen to your story, but how does that feel? You know, you see a baby, a child.
I think, you know, it's ironic that today we just got another child. She's actually the same age as Angel, who is one of our girls.
I remember Angel.
She's half the size of Angel. And she was brought today because her mother drinks and so neglects her and her sister. And her father assaulted her. So she has a cut from the top of one eye all the way across her face, all the way down to the other side.
A cut.
And we were, it's a wound, mm-hmm. it's healing. We were told she was hit with a soda bottle by her dad across her face. So she's been with us now about 2 hours, and I was over with her. You know, every baby that comes, you're just blown away that people could do stuff like that to anybody, to no matter your size or age. Your heart just breaks for them. But at the same time, you're so happy that we're here, because now today begins her healing. Today her life will begin to change. And so you can either choose to focus on the fact that this child was thrown out, or this happened to this child, or this to this baby, or you can look at today begins a new day. Today that past becomes history, and she has a new opportunity, and a new beginning starts. And so for me, that's what I have to focus on. That if I allow my emotions to dwell on what brought those girls here, it would be so discouraging, and you would feel like so overwhelmed, because we have so few here. And imagine how many there are out there. You know, they say that there's 3 million girls and women are at risk of FGM every year, which translates down to 8,000 girls every day. 8,000 girls around the world every day are likely to be circumcised. So as much as we need to understand those statistics, wow, and realize that that's happening, at the same time, if you just thought about all that all the time, you would be so discouraged. And for me, I could say, oh, I just have, you know, 20 girls here or 10 mm-hmm. girls here, and imagine 8,000, I'm not doing enough, which I'm not. I wish I could do more. But you have to focus on the positive, and that is that the baby's here now. That girl is here now, and this will be a life-changing experience for her. And she will never abandon her own child. She will never put her own girl through FGM. And so that's a life changed, a family changed, and eventually a community changed.
I remember you talking about this. I don't know if you're comfortable talking to this podcast about how you were struggling also, and how these girls were, you know, how these girls even save you, you know. And if I remember that talk that we had. That was really powerful. I want you to share that in our little humble podcast.
When throughout my childhood, from moving from different places and just being raised probably very differently than the average American child, there were a lot of things that I went through and struggled with personally. My parents did the best they could. When I was in elementary school, finishing up elementary school, we were at a mission station, and there were lots of families there, and there were some that had kids my age, there were some that had much older children, and one family had a son who was much older than me. And he forced himself on me. And I remember that I didn't tell anybody. It was so hard because, you know, you're all missionary families, and everybody knows everybody. And what will that look like to the community? And what would that look like to other people there? And I would be accused of this, and I would be blamed. Maybe, you know, it was me who caused all of it. And so for pretty much 40 years of my life, I relived that experience every day. I thought about it. I felt all the feelings. Every sense in me remembered every single thing that happened. And I never talked to anybody. And then I've always had this from living in Kenya and a lot of the time living around the Maasai people, I always had this strong feeling for the girls that had endured FGM. And I realized over time that I was drawn to them because of so much similarity between my childhood and theirs. They're circumcised by ladies, by family. It's your own mother holding you down and tying you up to have your clitoris cut off. It's everything is arranged for you and done that is hurtful by those you know, not by strangers. And then I could understand that because what I had experienced was from those around me, people who knew me, people who were part of our mission family. And then once you're circumcised, you don't tell people, you know, I was circumcised. There's no sign. There's nothing. You're not proud of it. You're embarrassed. And so once again, that was something I could relate to because I was embarrassed of what had happened to me. I thought I was a bad person. I thought I had done something wrong. And these girls experience that same thing. They don't feel valuable. They feel like they're not complete. They're not whole anymore. And so there were so many things that I could understand about them. And I think that's where this home, the trust came from was my feeling of there's so many people out there that are hurting, that have scars that nobody can see. We're all sympathetic, you know, we run and open the door when there's somebody with a cane or with crutches or a wheelchair, we'll hold the door open. We'll, you know, you see somebody who's blind, you see somebody who's burned. It's like people are so compassionate. And I realize there's so many of us that have scars that nobody can see. And from the outside, we look happy, we look confident, we look like we've got it all together. And on the inside, we're literally holding together, held together by stitches. You know, we're not complete. There's so much hurt inside of us. And I knew if, when I heard their stories and when I learned more about FGM and other things like that, I realized that, I am valuable too. I am worthy of being loved. And I thought their stories helped heal me. And in turn, I want to turn around and give opportunity for every girl that I can help to help her heal, to create an atmosphere that can help her feel so valuable and worthy regardless of her past and the things that she struggles with. So that's how this home, my past, their past, all meets here at the Trust, and we leave here different people.
Wow.
Have you ever told your story to any of the girls, Kim?
I have. Every now and again, I think they need a good lecture. I think it's important. Sharing is important. We carry burdens and I think sometimes we think that we have to be perfect. I was a pastor's wife. I worked at mission schools and students look at you and everybody thinks you put it on yourself that you have to be this perfect person. And when you're a pastor's wife, hey, you're like supposed to be there with a halo and on a cloud playing harp all the time.
Yep.
And reality is we're simply humans, mm-hmm. and we're struggling. Mm. And from the outside, you don't let people know that. And so I think it's so important to learn that you can share and you can tell people your story. And I think the girls gain strength when they look at me and they know things happen to me too. And I want them to learn to talk and share because them sharing can help another girl and that can help another girl. It's like a ripple effect.
You talked about their resiliency, you know, and I think a big part of it is because they're exposed to you. Mm-hmm. And I think you sharing your story to them is really important. I'll always remember the one framed in your library that says, "Broken crayons still color." And I think that's very powerful for them to just understand that, you know, even with everything they've gone through, that's not the end of their life. And that's what you do there. Mm-hmm. And they color. And I think you color, Kim. And you said that you'll always be a foreigner to the Kenyans. But for what it's worth, I think at least to the girls, your family to them. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's important.
Oh, thank you. Now you're going to make me cry.
That's what we do.
That almost made me cry. Yeah, thank you so much. You've been one of my, have inspired me the most, Kim. So thank you so much. You've always been an inspiration. I remember Kim talking about how in heaven, you know, we won't be having any scars because someone died for us. And he was like telling us about how the only person in heaven that will have scars is Jesus, because he had that scar, so our scars will be healed. So I'm happy for these girls.
Yeah, and the significant thing about that is he took those scars on purpose, and none of us have willingly asked for the type of scars that some of us carry. So yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Kim.
Thank you, Kim. We miss you.
We miss your passion shoes. Passion fruit juice.
You have to come back over here.
Hey, Kim, I'll be there
if
soon.
If I win the lottery, I'll come to the Philippines.
Come over. We'll take care of you. Thank you so much. Well, if you guys wanted to help Kim, the description, the information is in the description below. If you guys want to donate, you can also check out our program in childimpact.org. But if you wanted to visit Kim's site, that's almalikeatrust.org. Is that the right website, Kim?
Yep.
Almalikeatrust.org. Yeah, yeah. Or you can message her on Instagram. She's active there too.
And people can come volunteer, even dentists.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Yeah, you can come. They're dentists. They're nurses. You can come and help out. So please come. Yeah,
you can go safari and then spend time with the kids.
Yes, safari. Also, if you just wanted to be a tourist, you come to Kim's place and the proceed goes to the girl to help the girls with the safari.
Yep.
They have a nice safari camp there, so it's amazing. You should come. Thank you so much, Kim.
All right, awesome, guys. Thanks so much.
I miss you.
Wow, you guys finished the whole episode. Thank you for listening and journeying with us. We have more amazing stories in this podcast, so if you have not checked them out, please do. We release one episode every Monday. Join us next time in Beyond the Passport. Thank you for listening.
Dun, 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 dun.